Kicking off Poetry Month on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Rebecca Wee.
And I'm Don Wooten. David Wright not only writes poetry, but teaches it as well. We'll meet him today on Scribble. I mean, that's a double duty there, isn't it? Writing and teaching.
They go together, I think. They go together.
They do.
But I have a question, an overriding question. Do you like Johann Sebastian Bach?
A little bit more than probably is healthy for me. You can tell by a whole book of poems about and obsessed with Bach.
Yeah. I'm so curious about how you conceived of this, if it was a project that you thought of ahead of time or whether you just realized you were writing so many poems on this.
It's the second of those.
Is it?
I've been writing, I was a music major for a few years at Millikan University as an undergraduate.
All right.
And had a lot of classmates who were far more dedicated to the practice room than I was.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a lot of what I would call music envy poems, you know, poems that were kind of the engagement I would want to have had with a composer or with some music, if I'd had a little bit more diligence in that classroom singing into a mirror. And so I discovered after a number of years of writing that I was collecting a lot of poems that were about encounters with Bach, either hearing him or performing with choirs and getting a chance to sing them, or my college roommate, who was a brilliant concert pianist, hearing him play. So yeah, those began to collect. And then I thought, what do I do with these? And then spent several years reading and listening and going to every concert I could go to. And so the book, I then think, naturally grew out of that pile of Bach stuff.
You hit on something that registers with me, diligence, you know, practicing.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard.
It is.
It's boring.
Anything you have to do regularly is hard.
Well, what I discovered as an undergrad was that I loved making music. I loved being in ensembles. That time alone in the practice room wasn't my favorite thing. And so, but the time in the library, pulling all of the contemporary poetry books off the shelf, I could get lost for several hours
and
look up and
work.
Think, oh, I missed choir practice.
Yeah.
Singing in a chorus or in a quartet was more fun than is legal. I mean, it was just great. But sitting down and trying to get my hands to behave on the keyboard, it was just a lost cause.
Yeah.
So it's but a small book of Bach. It's not that small, David.
So that one came out in 2014.
It did,
is that right?
Yeah. The poems, though, probably started all the way back in the early 2000s.
So for the listeners, the book that we're talking about right now is The Small Books of Bach, which, is it three sections?
Four sections.
Four sections.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and then the more recent one is Local Talent.
Local Talent came out in 2019 in the fall.
Yep.
And then I was going to promote it a whole lot in 2020.
Oh, I know.
And so I think I gave a couple of online readings, but certainly couldn't go out and do the bookstore, college campus, library kinds of readings. But that's okay. The book is a very different book in some ways than the Bach book.
Yeah.
What I wonder about is how do you combine writing and teaching? You teach at Monmouth College,
I do.
Right?
I've taught at Monmouth College since 2013
and
taught a few places before that. You know, I teach creative writing, so that helps. I teach American literature, so that helps. So I'm always immersed in that activity and in those texts and with the students. But lately, I've just come to realize, and I know it's a bit of a cliche, that if I'm not writing well, I'm not teaching well. And for many years, the writing would take a side seat. It would be in the margins from the teaching because it's so demanding, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
If I find that if I'm writing, my energy, especially in the writing classroom, is so much different than if I haven't had a chance to sit down and get to the page on a particular day.
I should just have you two talk because you have similar obligations and problems.
Well, I'm envious of what you were just describing because I've been really bad at getting my own writing done because of teaching, which it's not that you don't feel sort of constantly mm-hmm. inspired by what the students are doing or something you've asked them to read or a classroom discussion. But I'm also I blame it on my children. I'm a single parent of young kids, and once they arrived on the scene, you know, teaching was sort of all I could manage.
I have a daughter who's 25 and got married this past summer, and my son is 17, and he's not with me all the time. But when he is, he actually likes to make art, and so times when we can kind of cordon off, do our thing, come back together. But I hear what you're saying about I had a sabbatical in the fall of 2020.
Okay,
and that reset me a little bit.
Did it? Yeah.
For writing. A chance to sort of realize what it was to come back to the screen or the page and not be unaware of what I'd done.
Yeah.
Because if you take that month off, those weeks off, you come back and you don't even remember mm-hmm. what you were working on.
Yep.
Sometimes.
Yeah, it's the creative process fascinates me. I wonder how people do it. But some are very disciplined.
Yeah.
Yep.
Some are just occasionally they have a burst of energy and write.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us only write on deadline.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they can all work. It's just it is a temperamental thing, I think. People can only write in the early morning or only write late at night or only write with music on something.
You talk about being a parent of kids and how that takes your energy and your focus
mm-hmm.
at times. I found that when my kids were younger, I could only binge write. So if I had a month in the summer –
yep.
I could write 30 poems in 30 days, that kind of thing. And then I would feed off of those poems for a year. Those were the ones I was revising and sending out and thinking about. That may be also because occasionally I would be off my ADHD medicine and I could sort of get the hyper-focus going.
Right.
But you know, that's the Bach book, the last poems in it grew out of a binge season like that, where I was thinking I need more of these, and was able to just immerse myself.
Well, we're talking about your poetry.
Let's read
I want
a
to
few.
Hear some of it.
Yeah, read some from Bach first. I'll since we've some, been talking
I'll read
about
something
it.
From the Bach book. Let me read a kind of a weird one here. Some of these aren't really canonical Bach pieces, as you might have figured out. here's one called Bach's Pentecostal Fugue for Electric Organ, Choir, and Tambourine. The way I hear it, a sweaty boy like I was a sweaty boy should have his hands in the air, should be swirling around a mouthful of words like wine, bobbing in his chair or on his knees or standing straight up. He should be two-stepping to the syncopated Jesus he knows lives in his heart, the one who has set up a white tent and called everyone home and can rip off electric organ riffs that make a boy either want to dance or get right with a much better God than he came with, or the one he had planned to take home.
That is different.
I'll take that, Don. I'm going to see that as a compliment and just move forward here.
It'd be a good title for a book, actually.
Yeah.
That is different.
It's different.
Well, you know, it's not a straight exposition of the prelude or his cantatas or anything.
It is not. There's a lot of poems like that in here that are really what I would call musical ekphrasis. You know, ekphrasis is the writing about pieces of art. And a lot of these poems will take a particular recording or performance or the composition process of a piece and talk about those. This one is, by the time I get to book four, I want to make my own stuff.
Yeah.
And this is pulling my kind of evangelical upbringing and all of the revivals and whatnot into space with the way that Bach wrote and repeated and wrote and repeated and varied things. So,
well, what fascinates me about a lot of the poems in this book is, well, in your other one as well, but you're focusing on Bach and on music, and so we've got a lot of that diction. But you're also working in forms. We've got sonnets and villanelles, and you know, you're
it's
working.
It's hard not to work in forms if you're going to work with Bach, because the forms
give
you a place to sort of approximate the music or to investigate the music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have, I was just flipping through this, the one that I wanted to hear just because it seemed so beautiful was the aria for Starlings in the Spring.
Oh, sure. I can try to read that one. Let me find that real quick. Yeah.
But then the other one I like, your titles are so compelling. The one that's titled Several Titles for Historical Bach Poems That Will Not Be Written.
That really was
such
a list.
Such a great idea.
That really is just a list of poems that I never got around to writing. And then I looked at all those titles and said, oh, I should do something. I'll read that one quick, okay?
Yeah.
Several titles for historical Bach poems that will not be written. At night, young Sebastian sneaks out of the bedroom at his brother's home and nearly breaks his fingers tipping cows. Maria Barbara sings praises to her husband's hands. Anna Magdalena removes Maria Barbara's portraits from the bedroom. Waiting in the nave after pulling an all-nighter, Bach lights his pipe and prays. Bach's motet for the judgment of administrative buffoons to accompany the chastising of Ernesti. Bach and the ghost of Augustine meet to discuss the Psalter. Years later, Bach and the Zipfelfagottist bury the hatchet over an inverted fifth, which refers to a fight that Bach had with a bassoonist. He called him a nanny goat bassoonist during a rehearsal, and the bassoonist threatened to beat up Bach, and Bach beat him up instead.
My goodness.
You know, the thing that amazes me about Bach, you talk about children being a distraction. No, I've never heard of anybody with as large a family as he had.
He did. Yeah.
And yet he had to write stuff every week.
Huh. He did. He was also really good at cannibalizing his own work, though. He would write something for a weekly service, and then he would use it later in a secular piece that he was writing for Frederick the Great. Or he was very good at sort of, I'll take that little motif and use it in the Easter cantata, because I, of course, wrote it for a service that didn't have as elaborate a performance. So I kind of loved his ability to borrow from himself.
Do you do the same?
Sure. Absolutely. I'm more likely to borrow from a poem I don't think is working. Rebecca probably recognizes this. You have a line that you think is quite, oh, that's great, but the rest of the poem doesn't live up to it. And you need to make it fit somewhere.
We do that with the students, just in free writing exercises. You know, they'll write for 5 minutes without stopping or thinking or plotting anything. And then the idea is most of that is just spillage, but find the one line or word or memory or something that came to the page that you weren't expecting, and that becomes your title or your first
line.
Start
from there. Start from that image. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
But you know, I get the impression almost that you are a poetic machine. You just keep writing.
I haven't been able to stop, even at times when I've tried.
Oh,
and,
that's wonderful.
Yeah, you know, you start to wonder, am I writing the same poem over and over again? And that's something that I try not to do.
Mm-hmm.
I write the Midwestern landscape poem. I write the music poem. I write the parent seeking a certain amount of solace for mistakes that you've made with your kid. I write the teacher poem. We all have our things we return to from time to time. But I think that's one of the benefits of teaching is I see and read and teach new poets all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'm reading Jericho Brown's poetry, or when I'm reading Diane Seuss's Frank Sonnets, or when I'm reading these very sort of immediate poems that are being written, Terence Hayes's American Sonnets for my Past and Future Assassin, I'm really excited to try some of that out.
You start thinking, it never occurred to me that you could do it that way.
Yeah.
Or do it that.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the process. You know, I'm a great one for form, and I wonder, when you start writing, do you think that you're starting a form, or you start writing and then squeeze it into a form, or do you use forms?
I use forms all the time. My favorite form that I keep returning to is the pantoum, which is a Malaysian form. It's a kind of repetitive folding form. I call it the villanelle light
in some
ways. And because I write a lot about music, I'm looking for forms that will not approximate exactly, but echo the way the music works. I like sonnets. I write sestinas, which are really fun. You give yourself those six ending words and then try to keep using them again and again in different ways. So I think if the subject matter seems to call for form, then I'm really eager to use it. A.E. Stallings has this wonderful lullaby for insomniacs that's one of her pantoums.
Yeah.
And it's kind of perfect. All of those of us who struggled with sleeplessness know what that's like to have the words and the images coming back and back and back again.
The pantoum is such a good form for, the kind of restlessness, what you were just talking about, themes or ideas or lines that come back. Do you know you guys can look this up if you don't know it, The Yellow Star That Goes With Me.
I don't know that
by
one.
The poet Jessica Greenbaum. And that was my first encounter years ago with pantoum. I'd never heard of the form, but she was writing about the Holocaust in these fragments that would disappear, come back, disappear, come back. And I thought, that's the perfect form, once I realized what it was, for being haunted in the present day by what happened to one's family or just historically. And it's because the form repeats certain lines and you get a sense of a few steps forward, a few steps back, a few steps forward. And that poem is really incredible in that form.
Jessica Greenbaum, you said?
Yeah. Yellow Star That Goes With
Me. I love using the pantoum when I'm teaching as well, because if you're going to repeat a line, then it better be a pretty good line.
A good line, yeah.
It better do more than one thing.
Yep.
And so it really helps me in my own writing. It helps my students, I think, to think about, is this line worth repeating a couple of times?
Exactly.
And then we often will write a collaborative pantoum. Everybody will give a line.
Yep.
And by the time we're done, we've written something we otherwise wouldn't have even considered writing.
Yeah. So we do that with Exquisite Corpse.
Yes, always. That's a great...
When I look at... One of my favorite poem, probably of all, is The Ballad of the Harp Weaver by Edna St. Vincent Millay. Mm-hmm. The form of that poem is demanding, and yet it flows so easily.
Yeah, like
and
it was
I
effortless.
Think, how did you do that?
Yeah.
I mean, how did you shape this into that particular form, and yet it reads as if it's just spontaneous?
Yeah.
And the words flow naturally. And to me, that is the magic in poetry that I will never comprehend. I sit down, I think I'll write a sonnet, and I go crazy because I can't make it flow.
Sound like it's just,
I don't know how you do that. Tell me, teachers.
I think it's sometimes, you have to have an ear for music, probably. You have to be fascinated by putting parts together. You know, there's play involved in working with a structure, you know, that
there's play, and then there's just enormous satisfaction when it clicks. I think it's if you like to do puzzles, if you like to play word games, if you like to play do crossword puzzles, that kind of thing.
Yep.
There's a little bit of that involved. I know woodworkers who like to do this.
Sure.
They dovetail the drawers perfectly, and they get it, and it clicks, and then they've got the measurement, and they know how to make it happen.
Okay.
I could read a pantoum if you'd like to hear
one.
Yeah, more poetry, more poetry.
Great, great. So there's a group of poems here called Box Toccata, Adagio, and Fugue for the Prairie States.
Nice.
And there's a couple of little pantoums in here, but this one is called Kansas, Little Fugue.
Okay.
The small gatherings of lights give a sense of purpose on the dark road. You found a road that seems right with no map. Give a sense of purpose and a body will follow a road that seems right. With no map, the names of places escape you, and your body will follow the hum of a rhythm you recall. The names of places escape you, like the lyrics of old folk tunes, the hum of a rhythm you recall, and the small gatherings of lights, the lyrics of old folk tunes on the dark road you found.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
It's not fair.
Well, I think poetry is supposed to be lots of things, but I don't know if it's supposed to be fair, Don.
Fair is an interesting way to think of it.
Are you currently producing another book?
I just wrote a little chapbook of poems that are kind of responding to the pandemic. I don't know that the world needs another book like that, but there are so many sources of stimulus in living through this, thinking through this, trying to make our way.
You have a pandemic poem.
I have one. I do. You want to hear it?
Yeah.
This is included in this wonderful Midwest Writing Center anthology that everyone should get. These Interesting Times, yeah. Surviving 2000 in the Quad Cities. Misty Urban edited it, and lots of other folks from this region, of course, have contributed to it. And I began to write during that time, partly because I was on sabbatical.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of wrote poems I found as kind of consolations or little litanies that I could think about. And so this is Masked Litany 1, Early June, and you can find it in this anthology.
Yep.
Breathing my own breath again, dark, scalded coffee acrid in a blue paper mask. Every other covered smile is a frown, or a smile, a numbed face, or terrified. I'm full of recycled air as I eye you, my unmasked brother, and believe you, Mother Bareface, when you show me you don't know or care to know, can't go to the trouble to believe in the trouble, that we are the trouble, and so I double my masks tomorrow. I mouth this masked, invisible litany because I can, not yet breathless, only restless in this skin, this face, these nervous hands. I too dislike my familiar breath today. I too am here to buy fresh bread for a table of one or two. I too could be, will be death for someone someday. Why do you think it has to be today?
Well, you repeat words in here and sounds.
Yep.
That is so neat.
I'm glad you enjoy that. I enjoy doing that, that's for sure.
Yeah. The litany idea, too, is wonderful.
You know, Robert Haas talks about how when you write a poem, you're putting your breath into the body of another person.
Mm-hmm.
And he says it's a very sacred kind of intimate thing. And I often think about that with sound, too. If someone reads your poem aloud, then the sounds that animated your understanding of whatever it is you're writing about are on their lips. They're in their mouth.
Yep.
And it's making them make the sounds you make, and then you hear them differently when they're said back to you. And I think there's something very powerful about that as a way of thinking about poetry. And I know a lot of us grew up appreciating poems on the page.
Yeah.
When I was in college, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
But then the spoken word movement comes along, and I think the return to form is, in some cases, an attempt to get that poem back in our mouth, in our body, the rhythms that we feel. And so I can't escape playing with sound.
That poem you just read, it's the sounds of it. You know, you can follow it on the page, and it makes sense, but it's hearing those repeated sounds.
Yeah.
It sings in a different way. People, I think, sometimes lose sight of the fact that when you speak and you inflect language, you are singing. There's music in the spoken word.
Sure.
So I guess I found my way through Music Envy Poems to a kind of music I could practice, could kind of get used to doing. And so that pleases me when that happens. And it pleases me so much when I read a poem that looks great on the page, then I read it aloud and it has another layer of resonance. And that's really kind of a wonderful encounter with a poem. The spoken one takes you back to the page. The page puts it in your body.
Your mouth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Billy Collins has a little essay from many years back called The Companionship of a Poem, and he basically says
that's a great
the same
one.
Thing.
I still make students memorize a poem and recite it to me once in a while.
That's what
And they
saying.
Seem terrified, but I tell you, they understand the poem so much better after trying to
memorize
it than they did before.
It's I know when we're rehearsing Shakespeare, trying to memorize lines, and there comes a point when all of a sudden it becomes your familiar speech, the lines come out and they make perfect sense. And then the whole process of memorization seems to lighten up a bit.
I think that's really true.
Yeah, that's well put.
Yeah, we used to, you know, when we were in school, we all memorized poems. And Roald Tweet used to knock me out. He could pull lines out of the air for anything you wanted.
Yeah.
He apparently had a memory bank of poems that he could summon at an instant.
I can do lines. I can't always do whole poems anymore.
And I can't do the free verse stuff that I love because I just can't memorize.
It's harder,
even my own poems, I think I've revised them so many times sometimes that I can't remember what stayed and what left have it in front of me.
I had my students memorize one poem a semester, and I had a student come into my office. It was the first two or three years I was at Monmouth, and he came in and he said, oh, Professor Wright, I'm having a really hard time. I said, well, Aaron, what should we do? He says, I fixed it. And he pulled the ukulele out of his backpack.
Uh-huh.
Ka-chink, 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 ka-chink. And he started singing an Ann Bradstreet poem, To My Dear and Loving Husband. It was amazing. And it was the worst ukulele playing and some of the most terrible singing I've ever heard. But he really nailed Ann Bradstreet.
He got it, yeah. That's wonderful.
There was a character who was a priest many years ago. And they were having a little party, and I think the things were turning liquid. But he made a bet that he could recite, what was it, Paradise Lost or something from memory. And sure, so the money went down and he started. And they were amazed. He had it.
Oh,
he said he missed about six words. And I think that is dangerous to have that kind of memory.
That's so funny.
Yeah, well, I don't mean to interrupt. How much time do we have left? Because I want to hear some poems, if there's time, from local talent.
You got a couple of minutes. So.
Okay.
Can I do one that's really an Illinois poem? A lot of these, a lot of the poems in this book are Illinois poems. And I grew up in the Peoria area and have been in and out of Illinois most of my life and different parts of the state as well. But this one is called The Devil Wears a Sweater Vest. And it's a prose poem. The devil wears a sweater vest and must often leave hell's surprising and comfortable climate and finds he needs the layered warmth here in Illinois where, in light of disbelief, a wind chill below zero and the beer-scented prayers of baseball fans, he finds himself currying favor with the bland and foolish, wishing for the labored, clever evils of the past. Hear this, he almost said. I too wear a sweater vest. Assembled by the hundred swollen hands of faraway children, I too mean no harm.
I can make a poem out of anything.
That's a great title, too. I really do admire your titles. Some people aren't so good at them, but every one of yours made you want to read it.
You know, I forget where it was that I learned the idea of weaving the first line of the poem in as the title, and that's become a habit. Now, maybe it's one of those I need to break.
Yeah.
But the poet Mark Irwin, I studied with for a short time, he used to say, quit putting a hat on your poem. So if you have a poem that just says love or grief, it's like a little hat on top of the poem, and you're wasting a chance to do a lot of really good work that a title can do. It can do so many fun things with a poem.
Right. Yep.
Well, you know, the whole business of structuring a poem, putting it together, and so on. Do you find it easy to teach?
No. I think students bring so many either no notions of what contemporary poetry does or strict notions of what contemporary poetry does that it's very difficult sometimes to help them unlearn an exercise like you were talking about, Rebecca, where you have them free write for 10 minutes and then grab the one surprising line out of it tends to jostle them out of their expectations.
Yeah.
But that's hard.
Before we run out of time here, where can people obtain your books?
Books are available in all the online places. I'm a big fan of bookshop.org because it tends to work back against the big giant place. I know that copies of Local Talent and the Bach book are at Wordsmith in Galesburg.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a lovely little bookshop if you happen to be down my direction.
Okay.
And if you want to find me online, my Twitter handle is @sweatervestboy. And if you message me, I'll be happy to send you a signed copy of a book.
Thank you, David. Great. And thanks for spending time with us.
We Great really fun. Thank you.
That'll do it for now. Rebecca Wee and I'll be back next week. And we hope you will, too, for another session of Scribble.